I said I felt sick at my stomach. It was the first week in October and I hadn't missed any school yet, so what could she say? She looked at me, but it was like she was thinking of something else. George was awake and listening. I could tell he was awake by the way he moved in the bed. He was waiting to see how it turned out so he could make his move. All right, she shook her head. I just don't know. Stay home then. But no TV, remember that. George reared up. I'm sick too, he said to her. I have a headache. He gouged me and kicked me all night. I didn't get to sleep at all. That's enough, she said. You are going to school, George. You're not going to stay here and fight with your brother all day. Now get up and get dressed. I mean it. I don't feel like another battle this morning. George waited until she left the room. Then he climbed out over the foot of the bed. You bastard, he said and yanked all the covers off me. He dodged into the bathroom. I'll kill you, I said, but not so loud that she could hear. I stayed in bed until George left for school. When she started to get ready for work, I asked if she would make a bed for me on the couch. I said I wanted to study. On the coffee table, I had the Edgar Rice Burroughs books I had gotten for my birthday and my social studies book, but I didn't feel like reading. I wanted her to leave so I could watch TV. She flushed the toilet. I couldn't wait any longer. I turned the picture on without the volume. I went out to the kitchen where she had left her pack of weeds and shook out three. I put them in the cupboard and went back to the couch and started reading The Princess of Mars. Note: A Princess of Mars, 1917, science fiction novel by Edgar Rice Burroughs. End of note. She came out and glanced at the TV but didn't say anything. I had the book open. She poked at her hair in front of the mirror and then went into the kitchen. I looked back at the book when she came out. I'm late. Goodbye, sweetheart. She wasn't going to bring up the TV. Last night she'd said she wouldn't know what it meant anymore to go to work without being stirred up. Don't cook anything. You don't need to turn the burners on for a thing. There's tuna fish in the icebox if you feel hungry. She looked at me. But if your stomach is sick, I don't think you should put anything on it. Anyway, you don't need to turn the burners on, do you hear? You take that medicine, sweetheart, and I hope your stomach feels better by tonight. Maybe we'll all feel better by tonight. She stood in the doorway and turned the knob. She looked as if she wanted to say something else. She wore the white blouse, the wide black belt, and the black skirt. Sometimes she called it her outfit, sometimes her uniform. For as long as I could remember, it was always hanging in the closet or hanging on the clothesline or getting washed out by hand at night or being ironed in the kitchen. She worked Wednesdays through Sundays. Bye, Mom. I waited until she had started the car and had it warm. I listened as she pulled away from the curb. Then I got up and turned the sound on loud and went for the weeds. I smoked one and beat off while I watched a show about doctors and nurses. Then I turned to the other channel. Then I turned off the TV. I didn't feel like watching. I finished the chapter where Tars Tarkas falls for a green woman, only to see her get her head chopped off the next morning by this jealous brother-in-law. It was about the fifth time I had read it. Then I went to their bedroom and looked around. I wasn't after anything in particular. Unless it was rubbers again, and though I had looked all over, I had never found any. Once I found a jar of Vaseline at the back of a drawer. I knew it must have something to do with it, but I didn't know what. I studied the label and hoped it would reveal something, a description of what people did, or else about how you applied the Vaseline, that sort of thing. But it didn't. Pure petroleum jelly. That was all it said on the front label. But just reading that was enough to give you a boner. An excellent aid in the nursery, it said on the back. I tried to make the connection between nursery, the swings and slides, the sandboxes, monkey bars, and what went on in bed between them. I had opened the jar lots of times and smelled inside and looked to see how much had been used since last time. This time I passed up the pure petroleum jelly. I mean, All I did was look to see the jar was still there. I went through a few drawers, not really expecting to find anything. I looked under the bed. Nothing anywhere. I looked in the jar in the closet where they kept the grocery money. There was no change. Only a 5 and a 1. They would miss that. Then I thought I would get dressed and walk to Birch Creek. Trout season was open for another week or so, but almost everybody had quit fishing. Everybody was just sitting around now, waiting for deer and pheasant to open. I got out my old clothes. I put wool socks over my regular socks and took my time lacing up the boots. I made a couple of tuna sandwiches and some double-decker peanut butter crackers. I filled my canteen and attached the hunting knife and the canteen to my belt. As I was going out the door, I decided to leave a note. So I wrote, "Feeling better and going to Birch Creek. Back soon. R. 315. That was about 4 hours from now, and about 15 minutes before George would come in from school. Before I left, I ate one of the sandwiches and had a glass of milk with it. It was nice out. It was fall. But it wasn't cold yet except at night. At night they would light the smudge pots in the orchards and you would wake up in the morning with a black ring of stuff in your nose. But nobody said anything. They said the smudging kept the young pears from freezing, so it was all right. To get to Birch Creek, you go to the end of our street where you hit 16th Avenue. You turn left on 16th and go up the hill past the cemetery and down to Lenox, where there is a Chinese restaurant. From the crossroads there, you can see the airport, and Birch Creek is below the airport. 16th changes to View Road at the crossroads. You follow View for a little way until you come to the bridge. There are orchards on both sides of the road. Sometimes when you go by the orchards, you see pheasants running down the rows, but you can't hunt there because you might get shot by a Greek named Matsos. I guess it is about a 40-minute walk, all in all. I was halfway down 16th when a woman in a red car pulled onto the shoulder ahead of me. She rolled down the window on the passenger side and asked if I wanted a lift. She was thin and had little pimples around her mouth. Her hair was up in curlers, but she was sharp enough. She had a brown sweater with nice boobs inside. "Playing hooky?" "Guess so." "Want a ride?" I nodded. "Get in. I'm kind of in a hurry." I put the fly rod and the creel on the back seat. There were a lot of grocery sacks from Mel's on the floorboards and back seat. I tried to think of something to say. "I'm going fishing," I said. I took off my cap, hitched the canteen around so I could sit, and parked myself next to the window. "Well, I never would have guessed," she laughed. She pulled back onto the road. "Where are you going? Birch Creek?" I nodded again. I looked at my cap. My uncle had bought it for me in Seattle when he had gone to watch a hockey game. I couldn't think of anything more to say. I looked out the window and sucked my cheeks. You always see yourself getting picked up by this woman. You know you'll fall for each other and that she'll take you home with her and let you screw her all over the house. I began to get a boner thinking about it. I moved the cap over my lap and closed my eyes and tried to think about baseball.
"I keep saying that one of these days I'll take up fishing," she said. "They say it's very relaxing. I'm a nervous person."
I opened my eyes. We were stopped at the crossroads. I wanted to say, "Are you real busy? Would you like to start this morning?" But I was afraid to look at her.
"Will this help you? I have to turn here. I'm sorry, I'm in a hurry this morning," she said.
"That's okay, this is fine." I took my stuff out. Then I put my cap on and took it off again while I talked. "Goodbye. Thanks. Maybe next summer." But I couldn't finish.
"You mean fishing? Sure thing."
She waved with a couple of fingers the way women do. I started walking, going over what I should have said. I could think of a lot of things. What was wrong with me? I cut the air with the fly rod and hollered 2 or 3 times. What I should have done to start things off was ask if we could have lunch together. No one was home at my house. Suddenly, we are in my bedroom under the covers. She asks me if she can keep her sweater on, and I say it's okay with me. She keeps her pants on, too.
That's all right, I say. I don't mind. A Piper Cub dipped low over my head as it came in for a landing. I was a few feet from the bridge. I could hear the water running. I hurried down the embankment, unzipped, and shot off 5 feet over the creek. It must have been a record. I took a while eating the other sandwich and the peanut butter crackers. I drank up half the water in the canteen. Then I was ready to fish. I tried to think where to start. I had fished here for 3 years, ever since we had moved. Dad used to bring George and me in the car and wait for us, smoking, baiting our hooks, tying up new rigs for us if we snagged. We always started at the bridge and moved down, and we always caught a few. Once in a while, at the first of the season, we caught the limit. I rigged up and tried a few casts under the bridge first. Now and then I cast under a bank, or else in behind a big rock, but nothing happened. One place where the water was still and the bottom full of yellow leaves, I looked over and saw a few crawdads crawling there with their big ugly pincers raised. Some quail flushed out of a brush pile. When I threw a stick, a rooster pheasant jumped up, cackling about 10 feet away, and I almost dropped the rod. The creek was slow and not very wide. I could walk across almost anywhere without it going over my boots. I crossed a pasture full of cow pads and came to where the water flowed out of a big pipe. I knew there was a little hole below the pipe, so I was careful. I got down on my knees when I was close enough to drop the line. It had just touched the water when I got a strike, but I missed him. I felt him roll with it. Then he was gone and the line flew back. I put another salmon egg on and tried a few more casts, but I knew I had jinxed it. I went up the embankment and climbed under a fence that had a keep out sign on the post. One of the airport runways started here. I stopped to look at some flowers growing in the cracks in the pavement. You could see where the tires had smacked down on the pavement and left oily skid marks all around the flowers. I hit the creek again on the other side and fished along for a little way until I came to the hole. I thought this was as far as I would go. When I had first been up here 3 years ago, the water was roaring right up to the top of the banks. It was so swift then that I couldn't fish. Now the creek was about 6 feet below the bank. It bubbled and hopped through this little run at the head of the pool where you could hardly see bottom. A little further down, the bottom sloped up and got shallow again as if nothing had happened. The last time I was up here, I caught 2 fish about 10 inches long and turned one that looked twice as big. A summer steelhead, Dad said when I told him about it. He said they come up during the high water in early spring, but that most of them return to the river before the water gets low. I put 2 more shot on the line and closed them with my teeth. Then I put a fresh salmon egg on and cast out where the water dropped over a shelf into the pool. I let the current take it down. I could feel the sinkers tap-tapping on rocks, a different kind of tapping than when you are getting a bite. Then the line tightened, and the current carried the egg into sight at the end of the pool. I felt lousy to have come this far up for nothing. I pulled out all kinds of line this time and made another cast. I laid the fly rod over a limb and lit the next to last weed. I looked up the valley and began to think about the woman. We were going to her house because she wanted help carrying in the groceries. Her husband was overseas. I touched her and she started shaking. We were French kissing on the couch when she excused herself to go to the bathroom. I followed her. I watched as she pulled down her pants and sat on the toilet. I had a big boner and she waved me over with her hand. Just as I was going to unzip, I heard a plop in the creek. I looked and saw the tip of my fly rod jiggling. He wasn't very big and didn't fight much, but I played him as long as I could. He turned on his side and lay in the current down below. I didn't know what he was. He looked strange. I tightened the line and lifted him over the bank into the grass, where he started wiggling. He was a trout, but he was green. I never saw one like him before. He had green sides with black trout spots, a greenish head, and like a green stomach. He was the color of moss, that color green. It was as if he had been wrapped up in moss a long time and the color had come off all over him. He was fat, and I wondered why he hadn't put up more of a fight. I wondered if he was all right. I looked at him for a time longer, then I put him out of his pain. I pulled some grass and put it in the creel and laid him in there on the grass. I made some more casts, and then I guessed it must be 2 or 3 o'clock. I thought I had better move down to the bridge. I thought I would fish below the bridge a while before I started home. And I decided I would wait until night before I thought about the woman again. But right away I got a boner thinking about the boner I would get that night. Then I thought I had better stop doing it so much. About a month back, a Saturday when they were all gone, I had picked up the Bible right after and promised and swore I wouldn't do it again. But I got jism on the Bible, and the promising and swearing lasted only a day or two until I was by myself again. I didn't fish on the way down. When I got to the bridge, I saw a bicycle in the grass. I looked and saw a kid about George's size running down the bank. I started in his direction. Then he turned and started toward me, looking in the water. "Hey, what is it?" I hollered. "What's wrong?" I guessed he didn't hear me. I saw his pole and fishing bag on the bank, and I dropped my stuff. I ran over to where he was. He looked like a rat or something. I mean, he had buck teeth and skinny arms and this ragged long-sleeved shirt that was too small for him. "God, I swear there's the biggest fish here I ever saw," he called. "Hurry, look, look here, here he is." I looked where he pointed and my heart jumped. It was as long as my arm. "God, oh God, will you look at him?" the boy said. I kept looking. It was resting in a shadow under a limb that hung over the water. "God Almighty," I said to the fish, "where did you come from?" "What'll we do?" the boy said. "I wish I had my gun." "We're going to get him," I said. "God, look at him. Let's get him into the riffle." "You want to help me then? We'll work it together," the kid said. The big fish had drifted a few feet downstream and lay there, finning slowly in the clear water. "Okay, what do we do?" the kid said. "I can go up and walk down the creek and start him moving," I said. "You stand in the riffle, and when he tries to come through, you kick the living shit out of him. Get him onto the bank some way, I don't care how. Then get a good hold of him and hang on." "Okay." "Oh shit, look at him. Look, he's going. Where's he going?" the boy screamed. I watched the fish move up the creek again and stop close to the bank. "He's not going anyplace. There's no place for him to go. See him? He's scared shitless. He knows we're here. He's just cruising around now, looking for some place to go. See? He's stopped again. He can't go anyplace. He knows that. He knows we're going to nail him. He knows it's tough shit. I'll go up and scare him down. You get him when he comes through." "I wish I had my gun," the boy said. "That would take care of him," the boy said. I went up a little way, then started wading down the creek. I watched ahead of me as I went. Suddenly, the fish darted away from the bank, turned right in front of me in a big cloudy swirl, and barrel-assed downstream. "Here he comes," I hollered. "Hey, hey, here he comes." But the fish spun around before it reached the riffle and headed back. I splashed and hollered, and it turned again. "He's coming. Get him, get him. Here he comes." But the dumb idiot had himself a club, the asshole. And when the fish hit the riffle, the boy drove at him with the club instead of trying to kick the son of a bitch out like he should have. The fish veered off, going crazy, shooting on his side through the shallow water. He made it. The asshole idiot kid lunged for him and fell flat. He dragged up onto the bank, sopping wet. "I hit him," the boy hollered. "I think he's hurt, too. I had my hands on him, but I couldn't hold him." "You didn't have anything." I was out of breath. I was glad the kid fell in. "You didn't even come close, asshole. What were you doing with that club? You should have kicked him. He's probably a mile away by now." I tried to spit. I shook my head. "I don't know. We haven't got him yet. We just may not get him," I said. "God damn it, I hit him," the boy screamed. "Didn't you see? I hit him, and I had my hands on him, too. How close did you get? Besides, whose fish is it?" He looked at me. Water ran down his trousers over his shoes. I didn't say anything else, but I wondered about that myself. I shrugged. Well, okay. I thought it was both ours. Let's get him this time. No goof-ups, either one of us, I said. We waded downstream. I had water in my boots, but the kid was wet up to his collar. His collar. He closed his buck teeth over his lip to keep his teeth from chattering. The fish wasn't in the run below the riffle, and we couldn't see him in the next stretch either. We looked at each other and began to worry that the fish really had gone far enough downstream to reach one of the deep holes. But then the goddamn thing rolled near the bank, actually knocking dirt into the water with his tail, and took off again. He went through another riffle, his big tail sticking out of the water. I saw him cruise over near the bank and stop, his tail half out of the water, finning just enough to hold against the current. Do you see him? I said. The boy looked. I took his arm and pointed his finger. Right there. Okay, now listen. I'll go down to that little run between those banks. See where I mean? You wait here until I give you a signal. Then you start down, okay? And this time don't let him get by you if he heads back. Yeah, the boy said, and worked his lip with those teeth. Let's get him this time, the boy said, a terrible look of cold in his face. I got up on the bank and walked down, making sure I moved quiet. I slid off the bank and waded in again, but I couldn't see the great big son of a bitch, and my heart turned. I thought it might have taken off already. A little farther downstream and it would get to one of those holes. We would never get him then. You still there? I hollered. I held my breath. The kid waved. Ready? I hollered again. Here goes! The kid hollered back. My hands shook. The creek was about 3 feet wide and ran between dirt banks. The water was low but fast. The kid was moving down the creek now, water up to his knees, throwing rocks ahead of him, splashing and shouting. Here he comes! The kid waved his arms. I saw the fish now. It was coming right at me. He tried to turn when he saw me, but it was too late. I went down on my knees, grasping in the cold water. I scooped him with my hands and arms, up, up, raising him, throwing him out of the water, both of us falling onto the bank. I held him against my shirt, him flopping and twisting until I could get my hands up his slippery sides to his gills. I ran one hand in and clawed through to his mouth and locked around his jaw. I knew I had him. He was still flopping and hard to hold, but I had him and I wasn't going to let go. We got him, the boy hollered as he splashed up. We got him, by God. Ain't he something? Look at him. Oh, God, let me hold him, the boy hollered. We gotta kill him first, I said. I ran my other hand down the throat. I pulled back on the head as hard as I could, trying to watch out for the teeth, and felt the heavy crunching. He gave a long, slow tremble and was still. I laid him on the bank and we looked at him. He was at least 2 feet long, queerly skinny, but bigger than anything I had ever caught. I took hold of his jaw again. Hey, the kid said, but didn't say any more when he saw what I was going to do. I washed off the blood and laid the fish back on the bank. I want to show him to my dad so bad, the kid said. We were wet and shivering. We looked at him, kept touching him. We pried open his big mouth and felt his rows of teeth. His sides were scarred, whitish welts as big as quarters and kind of puffy. There were nicks out of his head around his eyes and on his snout where I guess he had banged into the rocks and been in fights. But he was so skinny, too skinny for how long he was, and you could hardly see the pink stripe down his sides, and his belly was gray and slack instead of white and solid like it should have been. But I thought he was something. I guess I better go pretty soon, I said. I looked at the clouds over the hills where the sun was going down. I better get home. I guess so. Me too, I'm freezing, the kid said. Hey, I want to carry him, the kid said. Let's get a stick. We'll put it through his mouth and both carry him, I said. The kid found a stick. We put it through the gills and pushed until the fish was in the middle of the stick. Then we each took an end and started back, watching the fish as he swung on the stick. What are we going to do with him? The kid said. I don't know, I said. I guess I caught him, I said. We both did. Besides, I saw him first. That's true, I said. Well, You want to flip for him or what? I felt with my free hand, but I didn't have any money. And what would I have done if I had lost? Anyway, the kid said, No, let's not flip. I said, All right, it's okay with me. I looked at that boy, his hair standing up, his lips gray. I could have taken him if it came to that, but I didn't want to fight. We got to where we had left our things and picked up our stuff with one hand, neither of us letting go of his end of the stick. Then we walked up to where his bicycle was. I got a good hold on the stick in case the kid tried something. Then I had an idea. We could have him, I said. What do you mean? The boy said, his teeth chattering again. I could feel him tighten his hold on the stick. Half him. I got a knife. We cut him in two and each take half. I don't know, but I guess we could do that. He pulled at a piece of his hair and looked at the fish. You going to use that knife? You got one? I said. The boy shook his head. Okay, I said. I pulled the stick out and laid the fish in the grass beside the kid's bicycle. I took out the knife. A plane taxied down the runway as I measured a line. Right here? I said. The kid nodded. The plane roared down the runway and lifted up right over our heads. I started cutting down into him. I came to his guts and turned him over and stripped everything out. I kept cutting until there was only a flap of skin on his belly holding him together. I took the halves and worked them in my hands and I tore them in two. I handed the kid the tail part. No, he said, shaking his head. I want that half. I said, They're both the same. Now, goddamn, watch it. I'm going to get mad in a minute. I don't care, the boy said. If they're both the same, I'll take that one. They're both the same, right? They're both the same, I said. But I think I'm keeping this half here. I did the cutting. I want it, the kid said. I saw him first. Whose knife did we use? I said. I don't want the tail, the kid said. I looked around. There were no cars on the road and nobody else fishing. There was an airplane droning and the sun was going down. I was cold all the way through. The kid was shivering hard, waiting. I got an idea, I said. I opened the creel and showed him the trout. See? It's a green one. It's the only green one I ever saw. So whoever takes the head, the other guy gets the green trout and the tail part. Is that fair? The kid looked at the green trout and took it out of the creel and held it. He studied the halves of the fish. I guess so, he said. Okay, I guess so. You take that half. I got more meat on mine. I don't care, I said. I'm going to wash him off. Which way do you live? I said. Down on Arthur Avenue. He put the green trout and his half of the fish into a dirty canvas bag. Why? Where's that? Is that down by the ballpark? I said. Yeah, but why? I said. That kid looked scared. I live close to there, I said. So I guess I could ride on the handlebars. We could take turns pumping. I got a weed we could smoke if it didn't get wet on me. But the kid only said, I'm freezing. I washed my half in the creek. I held his big head under the water and opened his mouth. The stream poured into his mouth and out the other end of what was left of him. I'm freezing, the kid said. I saw George riding his bicycle at the other end of the street. He didn't see me. I went around to the back to take off my boots. I unslung the creel so I could raise the lid and get set to march into the house, grinning. I heard their voices and looked through the window. They were sitting at the table. Smoke was all over the kitchen. I saw it was coming from a pan on the burner, but neither of them paid any attention. What I'm telling you is the gospel truth, he said. What do kids know? You'll see. She said, I'll see nothing. If I thought that, I'd rather see them dead first. He said, What's the matter with you? You better be careful what you say. She started to cry. He smashed out a cigarette in the ashtray and stood up. Edna, do you know this pan is burning up? He said. She looked at the pan. She pushed her chair back and grabbed the pan by its handle and threw it against the wall over the sink. He said, Have you lost your mind? Look what you've done. He took a dishcloth and began to wipe up stuff from the pan. I opened the back door. I started grinning. I said, "You won't believe what I caught at Birch Creek. Just look. Look here. Look at this. Look what I caught." My legs shook. I could hardly stand. I held the creel out to her and she finally looked in. Oh, my God. What is it? A snake? What is it? Please, please, take it out before I throw up. Take it out, he screamed. Didn't you hear what she said? Take it out of here, he screamed. I said, but look, Dad, look what it is. He said, I don't want to look. I said, it's a gigantic summer steelhead from Birch Creek. Look, isn't he something? It's a monster. I chased him up and down the creek like a madman. My voice was crazy, but I could not stop. There was another one, too, I hurried on. A green one, I swear, it was green. Have you ever seen a green one? He looked into the creel and his mouth fell open. He screamed, take that goddamn thing out of here. What in the hell is the matter with you? Take it the hell out of the kitchen and throw it in the goddamn garbage. I went back outside. I looked into the creel. What was there looked silver under the porch light. What was there filled the creel. I lifted him out. I held him. I held that half of him. Sixty Acres. The call had come an hour ago when they were eating. Two men were shooting on Lee Waite's part of Toppenish Creek, down below the bridge on the Cowichee Road. It was the third or fourth time this winter someone had been in there, Joseph Eagle reminded Lee Waite. Joseph Eagle was an old Indian who lived on his government allotment in a little place off the Cowichee Road, with a radio he listened to day and night, and a telephone in case he got sick. Lee Waite wished the old Indian would let him be about that land, that Joseph Eagle would do something else about it if he wanted besides call. Out on the porch, Lee Waite leaned on one leg and picked at a string of meat between his teeth. He was a small, thin man with a thin face and long black hair. If it had not been for the phone call, he would have slept a while this afternoon. He frowned and took his time pulling into his coat. They would be gone anyway when he got there. That was usually the way. The hunters from Toppenish or Yakima could drive the reservation roads like anyone else. They just weren't allowed to hunt. But they would cruise by that untenanted and irresistible 60 acres of his, two, maybe three times, then, if they were feeling reckless, park down off the road in the trees and hurry through the knee-deep barley and wild oats, down to the creek, maybe getting some ducks, maybe not, but always doing a lot of shooting in the little time before they cleared out. Joseph Eagle sat crippled in his house and watched them plenty of times. Or so he told Lee Waite. He cleaned his teeth with his tongue and squinted in the late afternoon winter half-light. He wasn't afraid. It wasn't that, he told himself. He just didn't want trouble. The porch, small and built on just before the war, was almost dark. The one window glass had been knocked out years before, and Waite had nailed a beet sack over the opening. It hung there next to the cabinet, matted thick and frozen, moving slightly as the cold air from outside came in around the edges. The walls were crowded with old yokes and harnesses, and up on one side, above the window, was a row of rusted hand tools. He made a last sweep with his tongue, tightened the light bulb into the overhead socket, and opened the cabinet. He took out the old double barrel from in back and reached into the box on the top shelf for a handful of shells. The brass ends of the shells felt cold, and he rolled them in his hand before dropping them into a pocket of the old coat he was wearing. "Aren't you going to load it, Papa?" the boy Benny asked from behind. Waite turned, saw Benny and little Jack standing in the kitchen doorway. Ever since the call, they had been after him, had wanted to know if this time he was going to shoot somebody. It bothered him, kids talking like that, like they would enjoy it. And now they stood at the door, letting all the cold air in the house, and looking at the large gun up under his arm.
Get back in that house where the hell you belong,
he said. They left the door open and ran back in where his mother and Nina were, and on through to the bedroom. He could see Nina at the table trying to coax bites of squash into the baby, who was pulling back and shaking her head. Nina looked up, tried to smile. Waite stepped into the kitchen and shut the door, leaned against it. She was plenty tired, he could tell. A beaded line of moisture glistened over her lip, and as he watched, she stopped to move the hair away from her forehead. She looked up at him again, then back at the baby. It had never bothered her like this when she was carrying before. The other time, she could hardly sit still and used to jump up and walk around, even if there wasn't much to do except cook a meal or sew. He fingered the loose skin around his neck and glanced covertly at his mother, dozing since the meal in a chair by the stove. She squinted her eyes at him and nodded. She was 70 and shriveled, but her hair was still crow black and hung down in front over her shoulders in two long, tight braids. Lee Waite was sure she had something wrong with her because sometimes she went 2 days without saying something, just sitting in the other room by the window and staring off up the valley. It made him shiver when she did that, and he didn't know anymore what her little signs and signals, her silences, were supposed to mean.
Why don't you say something?
He asked, shaking his head.
How do I know what you mean, Mama, if you don't say?
Waite looked at her for a minute and watched her tug at the ends of her braids, waited for her to say something. Then he grunted and crossed by in front of her, took his hat off a nail, and went out. It was cold. An inch or two of grainy snow from 3 days past covered everything, made the ground lumpy, and gave a foolish look to the stripped rows of bean poles in front of the house. The dog came scrabbling out from under the house when it heard the door, started off for the truck without looking back.
Come here,
Waite called sharply, his voice looping in the thin air. Leaning over, he took the dog's cold, dry muzzle in his hand.
You better stay here this time. Yes, yes.
He flapped the dog's ear back and forth and looked around. He could not see the Satis Hills across the valley because of the heavy overcast, just the wavy flatness of sugar beet fields. White, except for black places here and there where the snow had not gotten. One place in sight, Charlie Treadwell's, a long way off, but no lights lit that he could tell. Not a sound anywhere, just the low ceiling of heavy clouds pressing down on everything. He'd thought there was a wind, but it was still.
Stay here now, you hear?
He started for the truck, wishing again he did not have to go. He had dreamed last night again about what he could not remember, but he'd had an uneasy feeling ever since he woke up. He drove in low gear down to the gate, got out and unhooked it, drove past, got out again and hooked it. He did not keep horses anymore, but it was a habit he had gotten into, keeping the gate shut. Down the road, the grader was scraping toward him, the blade shrieking fiercely every time the metal hit the frozen gravel. He was in no hurry, and he waited the long minutes it took the grader to come up. One of the men in the cab leaned out with a cigarette in his hand and waved as they went by, but Waite looked off. He pulled out onto the road after they passed. He looked over at Charlie Treadwell's when he went by, but there were still no lights, and the car was gone. He remembered what Charlie had told him a few days ago, about a fight Charlie had had last Sunday with some kid who came over his fence in the afternoon and shot into a pond of ducks right down by the barn. The ducks came in there every afternoon, Charlie said. They trusted him, he said, as if that mattered. He'd run down from the barn where he was milking, waving his arms and shouting, and the kid had pointed the gun at him. If I could have just got that gun away from him, Charlie had said, staring hard at Waite with his one good eye and nodding slowly. Waite hitched a little in the seat. He did not want any trouble like that. He hoped whoever it was would be gone when he got there, like the other times. Out to the left, he passed Fort Simcoe, the white-painted tops of the old buildings standing behind the reconstructed palisade. The gates of the place were open, and Lee Waite could see cars parked around inside and a few people in coats walking. He never bothered to stop. Once the teacher had brought all the kids out here, a field trip, she called it. But Wait had stayed home from school that day. He rolled down the window and cleared his throat, hawked it at the gate as he passed. He turned on to lateral B and then came to Joseph Eagle's place, all the lights on, even the porch light. Wait drove past, down to where the Cowichi Road came in, and got out of the truck and listened. He had begun to think they might be gone and he could turn around and go on back when he heard a grouping of dull, far-off shots come across the fields. He waited a while, then took a rag and went around the truck and tried to wipe off some of the snow and ice in the window edges. He kicked the snow off his shoes before getting in, drove a little farther until he could see the bridge, then looked for the tracks that turned off into the trees, where he knew he would find their car. He pulled in behind the gray sedan and switched the ignition off. He sat in the truck and waited, squeaking his foot back and forth on the brake and hearing them shoot every now and then. After a few minutes, he couldn't sit still any longer and got out, walked slowly around to the front. He had not been down there to do anything in 4 or 5 years. He leaned against the fender and looked out over the land. He could not understand where all the time had gone. He remembered when he was little, wanting to grow up. He used to come down here often then and trap this part of the creek for muskrat and set night lines for German brown. Wait looked around, moved his feet inside his shoes. All that was a long time ago. Growing up, he had heard his father say he intended this land for the three boys. But both brothers had been killed. Lee Wait was the one it came down to. All of it. He remembered deaths. Jimmy first. He remembered waking to the tremendous pounding on the door. Dark, the smell of wood pitch from the stove, an automobile outside with the lights on and the motor running, and a crackling voice coming from a speaker inside. His father throws open the door and the enormous figure of a man in a cowboy hat and wearing a gun, the deputy sheriff, fills the doorway. Wait. Your boy Jimmy been stabbed at a dance in Wapato. Everyone had gone away in the truck and Lee was left by himself. He had crouched alone the rest of the night in front of the wood stove, watching the shadows jump across the wall. Later, when he was 12, another one came, a different sheriff, and only said, they'd better come along. He pushed off from the truck and walked the few feet over to the edge of the field. Things were different now, that's all there was to it. He was 32, and Benny and little Jack were growing up. And there was the baby. Wait shook his head. He closed his hand around one of the tall stalks of milkweed. He snapped its neck and looked up when he heard the soft chuckling of ducks overhead. He wiped his hand on his pants and followed them for a moment, watched them set their wings at the same instant and circle once over the creek. Then they flared. He saw three ducks fall before he heard the shots. He turned abruptly and started back for the truck. He took out his gun, careful not to slam the door. He moved into the trees. It was almost dark. He coughed once and then stood with his lips pressed together. They came thrashing through the brush, two of them. Then, jiggling and squeaking the fence, they climbed over into the field and crunched through the snow. They were breathing hard by the time they got up close to the car. My God, there's a truck there, one of them said and dropped the ducks he was carrying. It was a boy's voice. He had on a heavy hunting coat, and in the game pockets, Wait could dimly make out the enormous padding of ducks. Take it easy, will you? The other boy stood craning his head around, trying to see. Hurry up. There's nobody inside. Get the hell in the car. Not moving, trying to keep his voice steady, Wait said, Stand there. Put your guns right there on the ground. He edged out of the trees and faced them, raised and lowered his gun barrels. Take off them coats now and empty them out. Oh, God! God Almighty! One of them said. The other did not say anything but took off his coat and began pulling out the ducks, still looking around. Wade opened the door of their car, fumbled an arm around inside until he found the headlights. The boys put a hand up to shield their eyes, then turned their backs to the light.
Whose land do you think this is? Wade said.
What do you mean shooting ducks on my land?
One boy turned around cautiously, his hand still in front of his eyes.
What are you going to do?
What do you think I'm going to do?
Waite said. His voice sounded strange to him, light, insubstantial. He could hear the ducks settling on the creek, chattering to other ducks still in the air.
What do you think I'm going to do with you?
He said.
What would you do if you caught boys trespassing on your land?
If they said they was sorry and it was the first time, I'd let them go,
the boy answered.
I would too, sir, if they said they was sorry, the other boy said.
Would you? You really think that's what you'd do?
Waite knew he was stalling for time. They did not answer. They stood in the glare of the headlights and then turned their backs again.
How do I know you wasn't here before? Waite said. The other times I had to come down here.
Word of honor, sir. We never been here before. We just drove by. For God's sake,
the boy sobbed.
That's the whole truth, the other boy said. Anybody can make a mistake once in his life.
It was dark now, and a thin drizzle was coming down in front of the lights. Waite turned up his collar and stared at the boys. From down on the creek, the strident quacking of a drake carried up to him. He glanced around at the awful shapes of the trees, then back at the boys again.
Maybe so,
he said and moved his feet. He knew he would let them go in a minute. There wasn't much else he could do. He was putting them off the land. That was what mattered.
What's your names, anyway? What's yours? You. Is this here your car or not? What's your name?
Bob Roberts, the one boy answered quickly and looked sideways at the other.
Williams, sir,
the other boy said.
Bill Williams, sir.
Waite was willing to understand that they were kids, that they were lying to him because they were afraid. They stood with their backs to him, and Waite stood looking at them.
You're lying,
he said, shocking himself.
Why are you lying to me?
You come onto my land and shoot my ducks, and then you lie like hell to me.
He laid the gun over the car door to steady the barrels. He could hear branches rubbing in the treetops. He thought of Joseph Eagle, sitting up there in his lighted house, his feet on a box, listening to the radio.
All right, Waite said. Liars. Just stand there, liars.
He walked stiffly around to his truck and got out an old beet sack, shook it open, had them put all the ducks in that. When he stood still, waiting, his knees unaccountably began to shake.
Go ahead and go. Go on.
He stepped back as they came up to the car.
I'll back up to the road. You back up along with me.
Yes, sir,
the one boy said as he slid behind the wheel.
But what if I can't get this thing started now? The battery might be dead, you know. It wasn't very strong to begin with.
I don't know,
Waite said. He looked around.
I guess I'd have to push you out.
The boy shut off the lights, stamped on the accelerator, and hit the starter. The engine turned over slowly but caught, and the boy held his foot down on the pedal and raced the engine before firing up the lights again. Waite studied their pale, cold faces staring out at him, looking for a sign from him. He slung the bag of ducks into his truck and slid the double barrel across the seat. He got in and backed out carefully onto the road. He waited until they were out, then followed them down to lateral B and stopped with his motor running, watching their taillights disappear toward Toppenish. He had put them off the land. That was all that mattered. Yet he could not understand why he felt something crucial had happened. A failure. But nothing had happened. Patches of fog had blown in from down the valley. He couldn't see much over toward Charlie's when he stopped to open the gate, only a faint light burning out on the porch that Waite did not remember seeing that afternoon. The dog waited on its belly by the barn, jumped up and began snuffling the ducks as Waite swung them over his shoulder and started up to the house. He stopped on the porch long enough to put the gun away. The ducks he left on the floor beside the cabinet. He would clean them tomorrow or the next day. Lee? Nina called. Waite took off his hat, loosened the light bulb, and before opening the door, he paused a moment in the quiet dark. Nina was at the kitchen table, the little box with her sewing things beside her on another chair. She held a piece of denim in her hand. Two or three of his shirts were on the table, along with a pair of scissors. He pumped a cup of water and picked up from a shelf over the sink some of the colored rocks the kids were always bringing home. There was a dry pine cone there, too, and a few papery maple leaves from the summer. He glanced in the pantry. But he was not hungry. Then he walked over to the doorway and leaned against the jamb. It was a small house. There was no place to go. In the back, in one room, all of the children slept, and in the room off from this, Waite and Nina and his mother slept, though sometimes in the summer, Waite and Nina slept outside. There was never a place to go. His mother was still sitting beside the stove, a blanket over her legs now, and her tiny eyes open, watching him. "The boys wanted to stay up until you came back," Nina said, "but I told them you said they had to go to bed."
"Yes, that's right," he said. "They had to go to bed, all right."
"I was afraid," she said.
"Afraid?"
He tried to make it sound as if this surprised him.
"Were you afraid too, Mama?"
The old woman did not answer. Her fingers fiddled around the sides of the blanket, tucking and pulling, covering against the draft.
"How do you feel, Nina? Feel any better tonight?"
He pulled out a chair and sat down by the table. His wife nodded. He said nothing more, only looked down and began scoring his thumbnail into the table. "Did you catch who it was?" she said.
"It was two kids," he said. "I let them go."
He got up and walked to the other side of the stove, spat into the wood box, and stood with his fingers hooked into his back pockets. Behind the stove, the wood was black and peeling, and overhead he could see, sticking out from a shelf, the brown mesh of a gill net wrapped around the prongs of a salmon spear. But what was it? He squinted at it.
"I let them go," he said. "Maybe I was easy on them."
"You did what was right," Nina said. He glanced over the stove at his mother, but there was no sign from her, only the black eyes staring at him.
"I don't know," he said.
He tried to think about it, but already it seemed as if it had happened, whatever it was, long ago.
"I should have given them more of a scare, I guess."
He looked at Nina.
"My land," he added. "I could have killed them."
"Kill who?" his mother said.
"Them kids down on the Cowichi Road land. What Joseph Eagle called about."
From where he stood, he could see his mother's fingers working in her lap, tracing the raised design in the blanket. He leaned over the stove, wanting to say something else, but he did not know what. He wandered to the table and sat down again. Then he realized he still had on his coat, and he got up, took a while unfastening it, and then laid it across the table. He pulled up the chair close to his wife's knees, crossed his arms limply, and took his shirt sleeves between his fingers.
"I was thinking maybe I'll lease out that land down there to the hunting clubs. No good to us down there like that, is it? Our house was down there, or it was our land right out here in front, would be something different, right?"
In the silence, he could hear only the wood snapping in the stove. He laid his hands flat on the table and could feel the pulse jumping in his arms.
"I can lease it out to one of the duck clubs from Toppenish, or Yakima. Any of them would be glad to get hold of land like that, right on the flyway. That's some of the best hunting land in the valley. If I could put it to some use some way, it would be different then."
His voice trailed off. She moved in the chair. She said, "If you think we should do it, it's whatever you think. I don't know."
"I don't know either," he said.
His eyes crossed the floor, raised past his mother, and again came to rest on the salmon spear. He got up, shaking his head. As he moved across the little room, the old woman crooked her head and laid her cheek on the chair back, eyes narrowed and following him. He reached up, worked the spear and the mass of netting off the splintery shelf, and turned around behind her chair. He looked at the tiny dark head, at the brown woolen shawl shaped smooth over the hunched shoulders. He turned the spear in his hands and began to unwrap the netting. "How much would you get?" Nina said. He knew he didn't know. It even confused him a little. He plucked at the netting, then placed the spear back on the shelf. Outside, a branch scraped roughly against the house. Lee? He was not sure. He would have to ask around. Mike Chuck had leased out 30 acres last fall for $500. Jerome Shinpa leased some of his land every year, but Waite had never asked how much he got.
Maybe $1,000, he said.
$1,000? She said. He nodded, felt relief at her amazement.
Maybe so. Maybe more. I will have to see. I will have to ask somebody how much.
It was a lot of money. He tried to think about having $1,000. He closed his eyes and tried to think. That wouldn't be selling it, would it? Nina asked. If you lease it to them, that means it's still your land?
Yes, yes, it's still my land.
He went over to her and leaned across the table.
Don't you know the difference, Nina? They can't buy land on the reservation. Don't you know that? I will lease it to them for them to use.
I see, she said. She looked down and picked at the sleeve of one of his shirts. They will have to give it back. It will still belong to you?
Don't you understand? He said.
He gripped the table edge.
It is a lease.
What will Mama say? Nina asked.
Will it be all right?
They both looked over at the old woman, but her eyes were closed and she seemed to be sleeping.
$1,000, Nina said and shook her head. $1,000. Maybe more. He didn't know.
But even $1,000. He wondered how he would go about it, letting people know he had land to lease. It was too late now for this year, but he could start asking around in the spring. He crossed his arms and tried to think. His legs began to tremble, and he leaned against the wall. He rested there and then let his weight slide gently down the wall until he was squatting.
It's just a lease, he said.
He stared at the floor. It seemed to slant in his direction. It seemed to move. He shut his eyes and brought his hands against his ears to steady himself. And then he thought to cup his palms so that there would come that roaring, like the wind howling up from a seashell. What's in Alaska? Carl got off work at 3. He left the station and drove to a shoe store near his apartment. He put his foot up on the stool and let the clerk unlace his work boot.
Something comfortable, Carl said. For casual wear.
I have something, the clerk said.
The clerk brought out 3 pairs of shoes, and Carl said he would take the soft beige-colored shoes that made his feet feel free and springy. He paid the clerk and put the box with his boots under his arm. He looked down at his new shoes as he walked. Driving home, he felt that his foot moved freely from pedal to pedal.
You bought some new shoes, Mary said. Let me see.
Do you like them? Carl said.
I don't like the color, but I'll bet they're comfortable.
You needed new shoes. He looked at the shoes again.
I've got to take a bath, he said.
We'll have an early dinner, she said. Helen and Jack asked us over tonight. Helen got Jack a water pipe for his birthday, and they're anxious to try it out.
Mary looked at him.
Is it all right with you?
What time?
Around 7.
It's all right, he said.
She looked at his shoes again and sucked her cheeks.
Take your bath, she said.
Carl ran the water and took off his shoes and clothes. He lay in the tub for a while and then used a brush to get at the lube grease under his nails. He dropped his hands and then raised them to his eyes. She opened the bathroom door. I brought you a beer, she said. Steam drifted around her and out into the living room.
I'll be out in a minute, he said.
He drank some of the beer. She sat on the edge of the tub and put her hand on his thigh. Home from the wars, she said.
Home from the wars, he said.
She moved her hand through the wet hair on his thigh. Then she clapped her hands.
Hey, I have something to tell you. I had an interview today, and I think they're going to offer me a job. In Fairbanks.
Alaska,
he said. She nodded.
What do you think of that?
I've always wanted to go to Alaska. Does it look pretty definite?
She nodded again. They liked me. They said I'd hear next week.
That's great. Hand me a towel, will you? I'm getting out.
I'll go and set the table, she said. His fingertips and toes were pale and wrinkled. He dried slowly and put on clean clothes and the new shoes. He combed his hair and went out to the kitchen. He drank another beer while she put dinner on the table. We're supposed to bring some cream soda and something to munch on, she said. We'll have to go by the store.
Cream soda and munchies. Okay,
he said. When they had eaten, he helped her clear the table. Then they drove to the market and bought cream soda and potato chips and corn chips and onion-flavored snack crackers. At the checkout counter, he added a handful of you-know bars to the order. Hey, yeah, she said when she saw them. They drove home again and parked, and then they walked the block to Helen and Jack's. Helen opened the door. Carl put the sack on the dining room table. Mary sat down in the rocking chair and sniffed. We're late, she said. They started without us, Carl. Helen laughed. We had one when Jack came in. We haven't lighted the water pipe yet. We were waiting until you got here. She stood in the middle of the room, looking at them and grinning. Let's see what's in the sack, she said. Oh, wow. Say, I think I'll have one of these corn chips right now. You guys want some?
We just ate dinner, Carl said. We'll have some pretty soon.
Water had stopped running, and Carl could hear Jack whistling in the bathroom. We have some popsicles and some M&Ms, Helen said. She stood beside the table and dug into the potato chip bag. If Jack ever gets out of the shower, he'll get the water pipe going. She opened the box of snack crackers and put one in her mouth. Say, these are really good, she said. I don't know what Emily Post would say about you, Mary said. Helen laughed. She shook her head. Jack came out of the bathroom.
Hi, everybody. Hi, Carl. What's so funny? He said, grinning. I could hear you laughing.
We were laughing at Helen, Mary said.
Helen was just laughing, Carl said.
She's funny, Jack said. Look at the goodies. Hey, you guys ready for a glass of cream soda? I'll get the pipe going.
I'll have a glass, Mary said. What about you, Carl?
I'll have some, Carl said.
Carl's on a little bummer tonight, Mary said.
Why do you say that?
Carl asked. He looked at her.
That's a good way to put me on one.
I was just teasing, Mary said. She came over and sat beside him on the sofa. I was just teasing, honey.
Hey, Carl, don't get on a bummer, Jack said. Let me show you what I got for my birthday. Helen, open one of those bottles of cream soda while I get the pipe going. I'm real dry.
Helen carried the chips and crackers to the coffee table. Then she produced a bottle of cream soda and four glasses.
Looks like we're going to have a party, Mary said.
If I didn't starve myself all day, I'd put on 10 pounds a week, Helen said. I know what you mean, Mary said. Jack came out of the bedroom with the water pipe.
What do you think of this?
He said to Carl. He put the water pipe on the coffee table.
That's really something, Carl said.
He picked it up and looked at it. It's called a hookah, Helen said. That's what they called it where I bought it. It's just a little one, but it does the job, she laughed.
Where did you get it? Mary said.
What? That little place on 4th Street. You know, Helen said.
Sure, I know, Mary said.
I'll have to go in there someday, Mary said. She folded her hands and watched Jack.
How does it work?
Carl said.
You put the stuff here, Jack said, and you light this. Then you inhale through this here, and the smoke is filtered through the water. It has a good taste to it, and it really hits you.
I'd like to get Carl one for Christmas, Mary said. She looked at Carl and grinned and touched his arm.
I'd like to have one, Carl said.
He stretched his legs and looked at his shoes under the light.
Here, try this, Jack said, letting out a thin stream of smoke and passing the tube to Carl. See if this isn't okay.
Carl drew on the tube, held the smoke, and passed the tube to Helen.
Mary first, Helen said. I'll go after Mary.
You guys have to catch up.
I won't argue, Mary said.
She slipped the tube in her mouth and drew rapidly, twice, and Carl watched the bubbles she made.
That's really okay, Mary said. She passed the tube to Helen.
We broke it in last night, Helen said and laughed loudly.
She was still stoned when she got up with the kids this morning, Jack said, and he laughed.
He watched Helen pull on the tube.
How are the kids? Mary asked.
They're fine, Jack said and put the tube in his mouth.
Carl sipped the cream soda and watched the bubbles in the pipe. They reminded him of bubbles rising from a diving helmet. He imagined a lagoon and schools of remarkable fish. Jack passed the tube. Carl stood up and stretched.
Where are you going, honey? Mary asked.
No place, Carl said.
He sat down and shook his head and grinned.
Jesus.
Helen laughed.
What's funny? Carl said after a long, long time.
God, I don't know, Helen said. She wiped her eyes and laughed again, and Mary and Jack laughed. After a time, Jack unscrewed the top of the water pipe and blew through one of the tubes.
It gets plugged sometimes.
What did you mean when you said I was on a bummer?
Carl said to Mary.
What?
Mary said. Carl stared at her and blinked.
You said something about me being on a bummer. What made you say that?
I don't remember now, but I can tell when you are, she said.
But please don't bring up anything negative, okay?
Okay,
Carl said.
All I'm saying is I don't know why you said that. If I wasn't on a bummer before you said it, it's enough when you say it to put me on one.
If the shoe fits, Mary said.
She leaned on the arm of the sofa and laughed until tears came.
What was that? Jack said.
He looked at Carl and then at Mary.
I missed that one, Jack said.
I should have made some dip for these chips, Helen said.
Wasn't there another bottle of that cream soda?
Jack said.
We bought two bottles, Carl said.
Did we drink them both?
Jack said.
Did we drink any?
Helen said and laughed.
No, I only opened one.
I think I only opened one. I don't remember opening more than one, Helen said and laughed. Carl passed the tube to Mary. She took his hand and guided the tube into her mouth. He watched the smoke flow over her lips a long time later.
What about some cream soda? Jack said.
Mary and Helen laughed.
What about it? Mary said.
Well, I thought we were going to have us a glass,
Jack said. He looked at Mary and grinned. Mary and Helen laughed.
What's funny?
Jack said. He looked at Helen and then at Mary. He shook his head.
I don't know about you guys, he said.
We might go to Alaska, Carl said.
Alaska, Jack said. What's in Alaska? What would you do up there?
I wish we could go someplace, Helen said.
What's wrong with here? Jack said. What would you guys do in Alaska? I'm serious. I'd like to know.
Carl put a potato chip in his mouth and sipped his cream soda.
I don't know. What did you say?
After a while, Jack said,
What's in Alaska?
I don't know, Carl said. Ask Mary. Mary knows. Mary, what am I going to do up there? Maybe I'll grow those giant cabbages you read about.
Or pumpkins, Helen said. grow pumpkins.
You'd clean up, Jack said. Ship the pumpkins down here for Halloween. I'll be your distributor.
Jack will be your distributor, Helen said.
That's right, Jack said. We'll clean up.
Get rich, Mary said. In a while, Jack stood up.
I know it would taste good, and that's some cream soda, Jack said.
Mary and Helen laughed.
Go ahead and laugh, Jack said, grinning. Who wants some cream soda?
Some what?
Mary said.
Some cream soda, Jack said.
You stood up like you were going to make a speech, Mary said.
I hadn't thought of that, Jack said.
He shook his head and laughed. He sat down.
That's good stuff, he said.
We should have got more, Helen said.
More what? Mary said.
More money, Jack said.
No money, Carl said.
Did I see some you-know bars in that sack? Helen said.
I bought some, Carl said. I spotted them last minute.
You-know bars are good, Jack said.
They're creamy, Mary said.
They melt in your mouth. We have some M&Ms and popsicles if anybody wants any, Jack said.
Mary said, I'll have a popsicle. Are you going to the kitchen?
Yeah, I'm going to get the cream soda, too, Jack said. I just remembered. You guys want a glass?
Just bring it all in and we'll decide, Helen said. The M&Ms, too.
Might be easier to move the kitchen out here, Jack said.
When we lived in the city, Mary said, people said you could see who'd turned on the night before by looking at their kitchen in the morning. We had a tiny kitchen when we lived in the city, she said.
We had a tiny kitchen, too, Carl said.